This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The U.S. Small Business Administration is searching for innovative products and services that help affect and empower the lives of women and families. Innovate Her is being described on the SBA website as a cross-cutting prize competition to unearth these innovative products and services. Valparaiso attorney Angela Cawson is with the local Innovate Her committee. We talk with her about this. What the U.S. Small Business Administration is looking for in particular to get women involved in finding ways to enrich not only their lives, but the lives of their families and the rest of America.
The Innovate Her Challenge celebrated its inaugural year in 2015. 2016 included a local pitch competition component. And from August 2015 through December 2015, universities, accelerators, SBA resource partners, Microsoft stores, and other organizations hosted local competitions. And how it worked, Chris, is that each host submitted one local winner to the SBA, who then identified 10 finalists. These finalists were then invited to travel to the Washington, D.C. area for a live pitch competition in which they could compete for up to $70,000 in prize money. What it does, specifically, it provides an opportunity for entrepreneurs throughout the U.S. to showcase products and services that have a measurable impact on the lives of women and families, has the potential for commercialization, and fills a need in the marketplace.
Obviously, the SBA has been keeping a close eye on women entrepreneurs for quite some time, and they've recognized that this kind of competition will just strengthen the need to get more women involved in the workplace, won't it?
Absolutely.
When you look at a project like this, it's a pretty ambitious project. It starts out at the local level and works its way up to the national level. What kind of organization has been set up by the SBA to be able to get the entrepreneurs interested in what they want to do, but also to compete, basically, for these honors and the prize money that I understand is coming along, too, with the national prizes?
The SBA actually oversees the entire event themselves, and the requirements for a host, we actually had to go through a little bit of a vetting process. I was actually emailed about a month ago by the Indiana SBA soliciting regional hosts for the event, and I just threw Businesswomen United Network's name in the hat, didn't think we'd necessarily hear anything, and we did hear back that they did grant us the ability to host it. With that, they give you some pretty loose rules. They have some regulations I'll go over here in a moment with you, but aside, we have carte blanche to create an event that really supports up and rolls up to their overall mission of empowering women to step out with their products and services and get in a little bit of the marketplace for some of the innovative ideas that have come to pass in recent years. I'm going to share with you the 2015 and 2016 winners. The 2015 winners, I'll share the first and second on both years. The first place winner was awarded to a gal named Bethany Edwards, and her company was called LIA Diagnostics. And they designed an eco-friendly, discreet pregnancy test that was easy to use and understand. And her and her team were based out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is a great one, Chris. The second place winner was awarded to Lisa Kreitz. She created the shower shirt, and it's a post-surgical, water-resistant garment designed to prevent post-surgical mastectomy and other chest surgery drain sites from coming into contact with water while showering. Mm-hmm. And she was out of Florida. And then I'll just share last year's winner with you, first place. Her name was Elizabeth Caven, and she created the Upcraft Club. And it's a website for digital sewing patterns. I thought this was pretty ingenious. And she's actually based out of Des Moines, Iowa. Just kind of gives you an idea of the diversity.
Well, it's very interesting, too, because as you mentioned, they're very diverse topics, very diverse solutions to problems that have come up in probably in local communities, but they've seen some expansion nationwide. I hope that these winners of these Innovate Her honors will be able to put something out there in the marketplace to be able to show something not only for their work in creating these ideas, but also turning them into some commercial successes. I imagine that's all the big part of this, too, is to make an idea something that could be easily replicated in the marketplace or sold, I guess.
Absolutely. The SBA on their actual website, where they have more information, indicated, and we both know this, that women in the workforce now more than ever are close to surpassing that of men. So gender equality is not simply about getting a woman a spot at the metaphorical table. It's just about the strides that they made in education, the workforce, and their role in the economy, and that there still is a need for strong women in leadership positions.
What kinds of efforts here in Northwest Indiana are you aware of that relate a lot to this type of challenge where business women and women that are just starting businesses are getting involved in coming up with some rather creative ideas?
I will name one right off the bat, and I'm hoping this is a little plea for her to join our competition. Her name is Lynn Jordan, and she is an author and also has a business. It's very interesting, Chris. She hand weaves rugs out of old T-shirts, and they don't have to be clean T-shirts. And she takes those T-shirts and creates some wonderful designs. When she sells those, she gives back 100% of the proceeds to two organizations that are set up to prevent sex trafficking globally. Mm-hmm. And she went as far as to go down to Haiti and set up a women's, kind of a micro business, I guess, and set up a loom down there so that those women in Haiti could also then in turn make their own profits and give back. So I would really love to see her, Chris, join the event. Mm-hmm. So those are some ideas. I have another lady that's setting up a business. She actually submitted her application. She produces microgreens. She's a cook and a caterer as well. So just some really interesting and diverse things going on right around us.
That's great. That's great. Go through the procedure now for anybody that is interested in getting involved in the Innovate Her Challenge. When are the applications locally due, and how does the procedure go from that point on?
Basically, what they would have to do is they would have to submit, and all this information is on Eventbrite and registration information. What they would have to do is send an email directly to me, and they are required to have a business plan. That's part of the vetting process, so that just shows that you're serious. Submit a business plan and then a one-paragraph to two-paragraph overview of your product or service. You have to be over 18 years of age, and as I indicated, the three primary criteria that they're looking for is that this product or service somehow benefits, measurably enhances women and families, has a potential for commercialization, and fills a need in the marketplace.
Now, with the local applications coming in, I'm sure there'll be some type of regional honor that'll be given out, and of course, that person will get involved in the next round of matters, whether it's the semifinals or the national competition. When do you hope that you will have an idea who might come out locally that, in turn, will go on for the honors?
We do have, like I said, a handful of applications already. Mm-hmm. We will be vetting those out. We have a really stealthy board of judges, some attorneys, local professors, local deans. They will be vetting through those. The competition is June 1st from 9 to noon at the Purdue Tech Center, 9800 Connecticut Drive. And once we get those applications in and we ensure that they've met all the criteria, then they will move to the actual competition. They will come in that morning and we'll have them an assigned time. They will give about a 10 to 12 minute pitch. And then after they leave, the competition will wrap up, the judges will convene, and they will select one semifinalist that will go on to the next level.
We'll know not long after the judges make their decision who the local winner is going to be, and then go on to the semifinals?
You got it. Well, we have a short deadline. We have until January 23rd to get that back to the SBA.
Wow. And then that's the time they'll gather all of the nominations nationally. They've come along this far in the process and continue to do their vetting process and working on taking a look at those particular projects and see if they're worthy of the national honors. What kind of national awards are available for those people that make it at that point?
They have a total of $70,000 in cash prizes. I'm glad you mentioned this because we've had some great donations locally as well. Mm-hmm. So the first prize winner received $40,000, and then after that it's a $25,000, and then a $15,000 award. And if you're familiar, you've probably heard of Spanx. Most men have heard of this because it's a prized product that women have spent millions and millions and millions of dollars on. Sarah Blakely founded Spanx, and she has fused this competition with money. So SBA partnered with her. So that will be at the national level. And then locally, we've had some businesses come forward and donate their services. So Purdue Tech Center is donating a one-year co-oping space for the winner. Hartman & Hartman Global Law Practice is donating some legal services. Britta Nienest, who's a women's coach here in Valparaiso, has donated some coaching services. Corey Mathis, an attorney, is donating some services. I am donating services. I'm an attorney, Angela Crossan, mm-hmm. and Crossroads mm-hmm. Chamber. They are also, they've been a great partner, and they're also donating a 1-year membership. So we've just got a number of businesses that are donating services to our local winner.
Well, Angela, thank you very much for the information. Once again, get the applications in, take a look at the information that's available online there on the Eventbrite webpage to find out more about the local Innovate Her Challenge. And we hope you get some great nominations. You have mentioned some already, and maybe a little nudge, as you say, to some people that have some good ideas that ought to put themselves in for a nomination bid. That's to be sure. Angela, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this today.
Thank you, Chris.
The president of St. Joseph's College has submitted his letter of resignation effective Friday before the apparent closing of the Catholic-affiliated liberal arts school. Email that went out to the campus community on Tuesday notified everyone of Robert Pasteur's departure. Back in February, the St. Joseph College Board of Trustees voted to suspend operations at the end of this academic term, which ended with the commencement on May 6th. Pasteur became president of St. Joseph's College 2 years ago. Trustees Board Chairman Ben Sponseller said in a news release that his term came at a very difficult time in the 128-year history of the college. Pasteur said that he didn't learn about the extent of St. Joseph College's financial problems until after he took the job. The college is $27 million in debt and has been operating with the St. Joseph's College at a deficit for many years. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill will continue to live in the Indianapolis area despite the repeal of a law that requires him to do so. Here's more about this from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Statehouse reporter, Brandon Smith.
Senate Bill 400 changed two words in the Indiana Code. At Indianapolis became in Indiana. That refers to where the Attorney General is required to live. The AG was the only statewide elected officer other than the governor statutorily mandated to live in the capital city. Bill author, Republican Senator Aaron Freeman, says that may have made sense when it was written in the 1800s.
You know, I think in today's world, with the travel as accessible as it is, that I thought I was an outdated law that we had.
While Democratic Representative Scott Pilas says that may be reasonable, he doesn't like making the change in the middle of the office holder's term.
I believe that when people run for office, they know the terms and conditions of the office that they're seeking. And to change that because it's an inconvenience or uncomfortable, I think, isn't the right thing to do. I don't think it's the right thing to do for any office.
Attorney General Curtis Hill, who's from Elkhart, calls the bill common sense legislation, but he notes he's lived in Indianapolis since he took office and will continue to do so. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
A provision in the proposed American Health Care Act, which would repeal and replace former President Barack Obama's signature health care law, would permanently do away with the medical device tax. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Becca Costello tell us, Hoosier lawmakers have been trying to repeal the 2.3% levy for years.
The medical device tax is particularly divisive in Indiana, where medical device manufacturing is a multi-billion dollar industry. Executive Director of the Indiana Medical Device Manufacturers Council, Kathy Hewer, says the repeal would have a huge impact on the Hoosier state.
Every dime that we pay over and above what we already do in taxes towards this medical device excise tax is another dollar that's taken away from either research and development or hiring new employees, expansion of plants.
Congress passed a 2-year suspension of the medical device tax in 2015. The AHCA passed the House last week, but extensive changes are expected in the Senate before a vote. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
National Weather Service officials say that all the rain clouds this month may hold a silver lining for Indiana. Hydrologist Al Shipe says that this year was shaping up similarly to the most recent drought year of 2012 until recently.
This was the second warmest start of the year to the record warm year of 2012. Starting in early May of 2012, it got warmer and drier. This year, it got cooler and wetter.
Shipe says that that means that it's likely that the state's probably at least forestalled, if not even escaped, the possibility of a drought this year. Here in northern Indiana, Shipe says that smaller streams are posing the greatest threat of any flooding that might happen. He said that isolated heavy rainfalls meant a boom or bust cycle for the tributaries of the Wabash River, which have seen low flow and flood conditions alternate in recent weeks. Al Shipe says that 2017 had been shaping up as a very dry year until the beginning of May. He says, unlike 2012, which was a drought year that had the same profile as 2017 until recently, the weather's turned cooler and wetter, which lowers the chance that the Hoosier State will suffer an arid summer and its associated water shortages. About 50% of Indiana's corn crop has been planted, but it's hard to say how many of those seeds will survive. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lita Noon talked to an agricultural expert, and she has this report.
Purdue Ag professor Bob Nielsen says saturated soils sometimes suffocate seeds and keep them from sprouting. He says only the northeast corner of Indiana has been dry enough in recent days to allow corn planting.
The vast majority of the state is sort of all suffering the same problem of frequent rainfall and soils that are simply too wet to have equipment on. And so pretty much the whole state needs, you know, a good week or two of drier weather.
Nielsen says a fairly significant frost over the weekend didn't help, and it's too soon to know if the emerging corn plants were damaged. He says farmers have about another month to plant or replant corn if necessary, and many have the option of switching to soybeans after that because of a shorter growing season. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee DeNoon.
Hoosier Academy's virtual school is one of Indiana's first online public charter schools. It earned an F from the state Department of Education for 6 years in a row now. More than 3,000 students attend in grades K through 12 from all 92 Hoosier counties. The Indiana State Board of Education may shut it down as early as today. In the second of two stories on this online school, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle tells us about the challenges of the school and the resulting pressure on the school's leader, who just happens to be a member of the State Board of Education.
Testing 1, 2. Hey, I'm doing a mic check real quick. Can you give me a...
Math teacher Corey Barnett is getting ready to teach class. She likes to make sure she can see each of her students once a day. That may sound odd, but Barnett is a teacher at Hoosier Academy's virtual school. All classes are totally online.
But we're making sure that these students are not just sitting there, but they're, and I always call it active learning versus lazy learning. And so, you know,
Barnett and others say lazy learning is one of Hoosier Virtual's biggest challenges. Students just not taking part in the online classes or logging on at all.
I should see 8 to 9 green check marks. Here we go. What is the lowest?
During Barnett's 6 years teaching at Hoosier Virtual, she's seen lots of teachers and heads of school come and go. On top of this, Hoosier Virtual has yet to work in many of the Indiana academic standards into its curriculum. These standards are the basis for exams like ISTEP and end-of-course assessments, the tests used to hold all public schools accountable. Barnett is one of the teachers working to address this. She's helping others incorporate more standards into the curriculum.
That's our strategy this year, and, you know, we'll kind of see. The proof will be in the pudding.
Improving academics at Hoosier Virtual is a goal for everyone. More than 80% of the students failed the ISTEP last year. And while some of the more than 3,000 students there thrive, in the past 2 years, the graduation rate at Hoosier Virtual has remained just above 20%.
John Marski, and I am board chair of Hoosier Academy.
Marski says early leadership and teacher turnover made for a rocky beginning at the school.
Obviously, whenever you have a head of school leave, the other potential is a lot of teachers leave. And so we struggle in those early days. And really, we hope, we believe we're stabilizing now under Byron.
Current school director Byron Ernest is an author and educator known nationally. He has more than 632,000 Twitter followers. He was recruited to lead Hoosier Academies in mid-2014 and was soon in front of the State Board of Education answering questions about the school's failures. It had 4 years of F ratings from the state at this point. Here's some discussion at a March 2015 meeting.
What is your mission and who are you recruiting?
We're recruiting any student that wants to come to us. We want to serve whoever wants that as an alternative for them, for their education.
During that meeting, the state board decided to wait 1 year before intervening at the school. 3 months later, House Speaker Brian Bosma appointed Ernest to the State Board of Education, calling him an agent of education improvement. This raised some eyebrows.
I would see it as an unfair advantage.
That's Teresa Meredith, president of the Indiana State Teachers Association. She's bothered that the board waited until this week. more than 2 years since that March 2015 meeting, to consider action against the school.
It seems inappropriate on the surface. It just seems like such a conflict.
I asked Ernest to respond to this criticism.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of people think you're getting a pass as this vote's been pushed down further and further.
Sure. Number one, I would say anyone that has a doubt about that should go talk to any state board member, and they will tell you that I have not talked about this, and nor will I. Not with staff, not with anyone. I have really, when I talk about being recused, I do recuse myself, right?
Past now, and current state board members I spoke with backed this up, as does current state superintendent Jennifer McCormick.
He has really done a nice job of just trying to stay clear of that, not swaying votes. But, you know, he's fighting for his school, and any great administrator would. So I respect that as well.
McCormick and other members of the State Board of Education will vote whether to close Hoosier Virtual down, limit its enrollment, or require new oversight at its upcoming meeting. As noted earlier in this piece, Ernest will not vote. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I am Eric Weddle.
The county had more than 500,000 residents, but since the beginning of the decade, the county's lost more than 10,000 people, raising concerns among the politicians and business leaders. What's causing the shift? In a two-part examination of the situation, the Northwest Indiana Times Byline podcast is looking at exactly what likely caused such an exodus. An aging position in the Rust Belt and millennials looking for their opportunities elsewhere.
From the Times of Northwest Indiana and nwi.com/podcasts, you're listening to Byline, the podcast about the newspaper's most fascinating stories and the reporters who tell them. I'm Cale Wilk, and this week Byline takes a look at migration in and out of Northwest Indiana. We'll talk with a researcher keeping a tab on population trends in the state.
You know, first of all, you can just tell by looking at the numbers that, you know, here in Indiana, you know, pretty much all the growth in the state is really driven by just a handful of metro areas.
And we'll talk with millennials, a group whose living preferences are profoundly affecting Northwest Indiana's future.
In terms of things to do, music, everybody goes to Chicago. For even if you live in there, you want to go to Chicago and play. That's the big ticket.
I'll start off with a little spiel to get things going. So you've heard me talk about things related to the region for almost a year now. I haven't really talked much about myself. Simply put, I'm 23. Obviously, I work at the Times, only graduated from Indiana University a year ago, and live in Schererville, the town I grew up in. I'm incredibly happy with my life right now, and lucky to be where I am. But upon graduating, and even leading up to it, I didn't have the same feelings. Working at the Times wasn't solidified yet, and I was searching for jobs, much like many of my other peers. Coming back to Northwest Indiana didn't excite me much at first. Living somewhere else did, though. I felt like I wanted something new. I almost made a decision to move to Charleston, South Carolina for a job offer, but in the end decided to turn it down after a visit. It wasn't until the flight back that night, and as I was descending into O'Hare Airport and saw those familiar lines of streetlights in the vast metro area, that it really kind of clicked for me that I felt right at home here in Midwestern Chicagoland. Not too long afterward, working for the Times became my job. So why am I talking about this? Well, today's episode, and actually the next one too, has some aspects related to people like me, millennials. Thus, I don't have to look far when it comes to finding any to talk to for obvious reasons. So in this podcast, there's three of my peers I got in contact with to see how they felt about something that's an issue for Northwest Indiana. And what exactly that is what we're going to get into starting now. Right now, I'm walking along Hubbard Street in Chicago. I'm about to meet up with somebody.
Coffee maker. Probably make some coffee in there. I don't know if you're... I remember you said you're a coffee drinker or not.
Oh, no, I don't drink coffee.
I'm cool with just like a glass of water or something. Okay. That's my thing.
That someone is Matt Meshdi. He's welcomed me into his apartment for an interview. I came to talk with him about how his life is in the city.
A large amount of my friends moved to Chicago because that's just what you did, because it seemed like such a close thing. It was close to home, an hour away, but also it was a way, much like you feel like when you go off to college or something initially, where you're just like, oh, I'm free, you know, I'm taking the next step in my life as an adult, going to college, getting, you know, being on my own, looking after myself, whatever. And then when you graduate, it's the same kind of like next step where you're just like, oh, I want to escape, or, you know, move like up it a little bit and move to the big city and try it out.
Matt's a freelance filmmaker and an occasional correspondent for the Times. He originally earned a business degree from Purdue University and worked in advertising and marketing for a social media company called Superfly. He's lived in the city for 3 years. But, like I've noted before, his origin from Northwest Indiana is of importance to this week's topic.
Because I always felt like we had the best of both worlds, just like I do now. We have the tougher attitude that some of like my parents and my dad and my uncles and stuff had growing up, as working in the mill and being mill rats and things like that. I don't know. I think it makes you a certain kind of person. You're half in the door, half out of the cornfields and also the city. So you get like a dual perspective on the world from the city-minded people and also country-minded people. And you're like sitting right in the middle of it. So
see, the thing about Matt is that he's one of many young millennials that have opted to move to an urban environment in pursuit of job opportunities. But this pursuit among others in our age group may be contributing to a local problem. For the past few years, Northwest Indiana hasn't entirely grown, especially in Lake County. And I specifically said entirely because it's a little weird. There's some growth, but not all over, nor at similar rates. We'll go ahead and dive in by talking with this week's featured reporter.
Joseph Peets, business reporter at the Times of Northwest Indiana.
Joseph Peets has been tracking this in the recent past. He analyzes figures and data annually when they're made available from the U.S. Census Bureau, the Internal Revenue Service, the Indiana Business Research Center, and more that can point to how this population shift is going.
You know, as part of my responsibility as a business reporter, I cover, you know, population shifts as part of the overall economic coverage. And I'm signed up for, you know, U.S. Census Bureau does news releases throughout the years. It actually generates many interesting and insightful stories that tells us a lot through data about, you know, Northwest Indiana, the state, the Chicago metro, and the world. People like to know if their community is growing or shrinking or stagnant or, you know, where it's headed.
And he's found some interesting results. The Indiana Business Research Center reports that since the beginning of the decade, out of the three region counties, Porter County is the only one that's consistently grown, having gained over 3,000 residents over the past 6 years, which is a 2.6% growth. LaPorte County has gone up and down in small increments with its population, in which it dipped down last year. For the past 6 years, it overall has lost almost 1,500 residents, a 1.3% decrease. And Lake County, well, it's only gone down since the beginning of the decade. It's lost over 10,000 residents in that time period, which is a 2% decrease for it.
We're down to like 485,000 now people, it's estimated, in Lake County. At one point, Lake County had had more than, you know, 540 residents or so. We did have a growth spurt at the beginning of this millennium, but it's been kind of, the past decade's been a little harsh. We've been losing residents every year. We're losing more than any other county in the state by a wide margin.
Joseph, as you may remember from previous episodes, keeps a finger on the pulse of the steel industry. And that exact thing may be something to look at as to why this is happening.
It's not even entirely through any fault of our own that this is happening. Nationally, if you look at the census numbers, for years and years and years, there has been an outward migration from the industrial Midwest to the Sun Belt, to the South. People have been going to warmer climates for years. What drew people to the Midwest in the first place is you had heavy industry, you had tons of jobs. We had people from all over Eastern Europe, people from the South, you know, we were once a magnet that drew people from immigrants from the world over, and you just don't have that anymore. The mills employ a fragment of the people they once did, and population, you know, if you have the choice between suffering through a bad winter or living in Phoenix, a lot of people, unfortunately, are choosing to go move to Phoenix or Florida or, you know, wherever.
And it may not be just steel, but manufacturing as a whole, which has historically been the backbone of this area. The unemployment rate in Indiana has been slowly going down, as well as job growth slowly going up. But those changes have been occurring elsewhere outside of Northwest Indiana. The decline in industry is a symptom in other places aside from the Great Lakes region, from the Appalachian Mountains to the Great Plains. Within these areas lie pockets that have been nicknamed the Rust Belt, and include not only places like Gary or South Bend, but other cities like Cleveland, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or St. Louis, Missouri. With the strength of their industries hiccuping and sputtering, whether it be steel, automobiles, and more, the potential for community growth is fading in some of these areas, as not only older workers don't have jobs, but perhaps also the young. That's something we called this man about.
This is Matt.
This is Matthew Kinghorn, a demographer at the Indiana Business Research Center at Indiana University in Bloomington. Joseph has also spoken with him for his stories on this topic.
We, among our research areas of expertise, are demographic analyses and demographic projections. And along with that, we work with the Census Bureau to help them produce annual population estimates. And we also provide support during the decennial census.
What these trends tend to come down to is quality of life and what millennials want in an ideal, satisfying lifestyle. It's tricky to define, as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention notes that it's mainly used as a way to measure health-related statistics and options, but has evolved into a subjective, multidimensional descriptor. For our purposes here, we're looking at it in regards to amenities and affordability. And cities are the places that are proving to be appealing. So the idea goes that where the jobs are is where the people will be drawn to. But it may also have to do with the effects of the recent Great Recession.
Houses weren't being built. People didn't feel economically secure enough to make a big move. All those sorts of factors, led to a lot of people just being stuck in place, basically. You know, here in Indiana, you know, pretty much all the growth in the state is really driven by just a handful of metro areas. And so you have central Indiana, the Indianapolis area certainly leads the way. Something that we saw in the wake of the recession was a lot of kind of an apartment boom in urban areas. You saw that in Indianapolis. You saw it, you know, really around the country. And so that could have been another nod at preferences of millennials.
So millennials look for something that's not only affordable to them, but is also meeting their preferences. And what are those? Sometimes it's hard to pinpoint, because the results seem to show that millennials are finicky. But here's what some might say. A Gallup report titled How Millennials Want to Work and Live said that this group wants an active and engaged community with strong social ties. A data story from Goldman Sachs titled Millennials Coming of Age says that among those surveyed, they have a reluctance to buy homes, and many are renting. They're not buying many material items like cars or luxury goods, opting instead to share. They aren't attracted to big brands, and instead gravitate towards smaller businesses, and would rather be purchasing quality goods, even if it meant more money.
You know, the key is a diversifying economy. You know, when you look, if you look at the, you know, the Midwest, you know, we there are certainly all the Rust Belt cities that we think of, the Clevelands, Detroits, you know, or even the Gary. But then also within the Midwest, we have you know, what are some emerging metro areas that maybe aren't as tied to that industrial past that some of those, you know, heavy manufacturing communities are. You know, if you look at Columbus, Ohio, or Indianapolis, Madison, Wisconsin, even the Twin Cities in Minnesota, they're growing at a much, you know, population-wise, they're growing at a much faster rate than Detroit or Cleveland, you know, are, or Chicago even. And so I think that you know, all those amenities are important as well as education, strong schools. But it's going to be that economic base and making it as economically competitive as possible is what's going to draw young people.
Now, Matt mentioned Indianapolis, which is where one of those other peers is living.
Stephanie Strumpluski. I'm a video production assistant for the Indianapolis Indians.
Stephanie, who's 23, actually recently moved to the city. Well, Greenwood, to be more specific, which is one of the first towns after you exit the southern city limits. She's originally from Illinois, having spent time growing up in Chicago's East Side neighborhood and South Holland, later moved to Dyer, and then eventually also went to Indiana University, where she and I met as journalism students. She also found the job search to be a little difficult.
I started about February of my senior year, so like 3 months left until graduation, and I think in a month I had applied to like 60 different jobs or internships on this specific sports website that I was using to find production and broadcasting jobs, and didn't really find anything. There was zero luck. So it was a really hard process because you didn't know if you were going to hear back from any job you were applying to. And it took me about, I was applying in jobs in February, didn't really hear back. I applied to a couple more jobs in September, and that's how I got the job with the Blackhawks, the same website that I was applying to.
Throughout her time as a journalism student, Stephanie gravitated toward the broadcast side of things, and it's still her dream path in the field. Last year, she interviewed for and earned a community relations position with the Chicago Blackhawks, but the position was only for a year. She had to start looking elsewhere. And while sending her resume and cover letters around to different organizations and markets, she eventually was successful in getting the position she has now with the Indianapolis Indians, a minor league baseball affiliate team. And she's enjoyed her time thus far.
Well, that's pretty good. I live in a pretty vibrant area. I didn't think it was going to be vibrant at all. I thought it was going to be pretty dead. But I'm surrounded by restaurants and grocery stores, and there's a mall like 15 minutes away. I'm only 30 minutes from the city. So everything is fairly close. So I'm really enjoying the atmosphere so far.
I asked Stephanie about if being in a city or very urban environment affected her preferences on where she'd want to be.
Definitely how vibrant a town is. And by that, I just mean, is there nightlife happening? Is there people that actually want to be here and they want to live here? And, they want to actually go out and live their lives. I want to be a part of the vibrancy and people going out for drinks and having fun and, wanting to be a part of the community and, going to, whatever shows are happening downtown. But at the time, I think maybe a couple of years ago, I wanted to live downtown in the city just so that I would be closer to things. And if I actually had a job downtown, then I would be closer to my job. I'm not really sure if I have the same exact goal I did to live in the city anymore. But, in the next couple of years, if the opportunity presents itself, I'd like to give a try. I would like to give it a try, like living in the city and see how it's like.
I also asked Stephanie whether or not this meant Northwest Indiana proved to be an appealing place for her. Chicagoland wasn't proving fruitful as a place where she could find employment, but did it have the same quality of life being afforded for her in her current home?
When I was little, I really hated it, but growing up, I started to appreciate it. So I've really appreciated what Northwest Indiana has given me. I don't know if I see it as super vibrant, but I'll see people that want to go out and they want to go out to the movies, or they want to go out to a couple nice bars, or they want to go out to the mall in Maryville. But I don't think it has a super, nightlife atmosphere. No.
It's a tricky thing to help ensure growth in Northwest Indiana, as there are multiple factors that play into this. So I wanted to talk to someone who has a knowledge on what the temperature is like for Northwest Indiana's business environment. So I sat down with Heather Ennis, the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum.
Growing Northwest Indiana's economy is kind of the way I would describe it. We are investing in the future of Northwest Indiana. We're working with the companies that are here to help streamline ways that they can invest in the economy here. So whether it's growth in their company, attracting more talent, helping to get through regulatory processes, things of that nature.
Heather and her counterparts meet with other business leaders and try to attract and keep their work here. She's not able to give me specific names of who they meet with, as that dives into trade secrets or could reveal business decisions about, say, for example, a company relocating from a different state to Indiana, which would impact that area or the company's employees. But they do review their work. And from a broad look, according to the group's 2016 year in review, they met with almost 200 site selectors, brokers, and developers, saw around 1,200 jobs created, and almost $250 million in new investment. But Heather does note that a lot of this investment or development is in the realm of manufacturing.
Indiana, we make things and we grow things, typically is who we are, and that's a blessing and a curse. So the beautiful thing about making things and growing things is that you have product and you have things that are great for the market. It's not just a service economy. The downside is with automation, you can make things and grow things with fewer people. So we need to continue to diversify who we are and what our opportunities are and what we're making and growing. So when, you know, we've had such a great blessing to have the steel mills be right here in Northwest Indiana, and to be able to produce 20% of the U.S. steel right here in our region is phenomenal. But we've been able to do it with fewer and fewer people. So in order to keep those people gainfully employed, we've had to attract other types of manufacturing in order to keep in, and some of those skills aren't necessarily transferable between one and the other.
I also asked Heather a tricky question about what we want to be in this area. What is our identity? How do we position ourselves? Are we a suburb of Chicago and a bedroom community rich land? Are we an economic power source of Indiana? Who do we identify with, and who do we want to see grow?
We tend to look at everything like it's a zero-sum game from Northwest Indiana, and it's a shame. The fact that we're a stone's throw away from the third largest economy in the country is huge, and we should never be embarrassed of our proximity to the city of Chicago. It is an outstanding factor for us, and it's thriving because it's a vibrant place where people want to be. Well, Northwest Indiana is a vibrant place where people want to be as well, but sometimes people that are here forget that.
And someone who believes that is this person.
I'm Brandon Kickmull, and I'm a civil engineer.
Brandon is the third and final peer I'd like to include here. He's 24 and works as a civil engineer at DeShiel Corporation in Oak Brook, but he keeps his residence in Chicago's Wicker Park neighborhood. In July, he'll have been living in the city for 2 years. He graduated with a degree from Purdue University Northwest, back when it was so-called Purdue University Calumet. But Chicago has always been something that's been a goal for him.
One of the things that I did like growing up a lot is that it's just being very close to the city, and just having that South Shore train as an easy access, as if I didn't have my driver's license, it was an easy way just to, get to the city without, actually having to drive. Or, if it's something, like a big event going on, of course, major traffic, easy way to get in there. So, that's always something that, I've always liked growing up, because I've always liked going to the city because there's, many things to do.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, broadly speaking, the fields growing fastest in jobs are science and technology related, whether that involves medicine, engineering, etc. And when I talked to Brandon, he said some job positions with firms were available in Northwest Indiana, but not as much as compared to neighboring Chicago. Coming out of college, he had 3 offers to work for firms in either San Antonio, Texas, Tampa, Florida, or Chicago. The rest is history.
Yeah. Like I would always say, when I was doing my initial job search, Chicago was always my preferred, area. The other areas that, I was considering was, was Indianapolis, because, you know, that's like a big city, but, you know, it doesn't, or sorry, it's like not like that large of a, you know, big city, but, you know, it does kind of feel like a big city, but, you know, everything's very compact and, you know, close together, easy to get to different things. And then I also did like Arizona a lot just because of the warm weather.
Although Brandon's job is in Oak Brook rather than within Chicago proper, being closer to his work site was one thing that he valued over a longer commute from Northwest Indiana. And Chicago's amenities are all that he could have hoped for.
The one thing that, you know, I really like, you know, that, you know, always draw, like always drew me to the city is that, like, I like to, you know, be like very active when, you know, it's like being like outside or, you know, going to, you know, a lot of concerts. Cause like I, you know, I do enjoy going to concerts a lot. So, you know, just, you know, being very close to concerts, you know, either just taking an Uber or, you know, the bus or the train to concert venue opposed to, you know, just driving from, you know, Indiana or, you know, taking the South Shore. It's just a little bit more convenient for that. So, yeah, I would definitely say that, you know, just, you know, the array of activities and, you know, things to do, that there's always something going on in the city, whether it's, you know, some type of street festival, music festival, you know, the beach, you know, a new brewery, a new restaurant or something.
But he did note he does value Northwest Indiana for what it provided him and doesn't dislike the area or find it unappealing. He did note it may be a place he would return to in the future.
I don't see myself like living in Chicago for like the rest of my life. You know, I'm just, you know, like, while, you know, I'm, you know, young and everything, you know, I guess, you know, want to experience what the big city has to have, but, you know, when it's time to, you know, get married and have kids, obviously I wouldn't want to raise kids in, you know, a big city. Cause, you know, like, you know, kids like to run around and, you know, they're rambunctious and whatnot. And, you know, with, you know, with the city, there's, you know, it's a little bit harder to do that because it's all pavement around here. There's not much grass, you know, parks are all spread out.
Finally, let's go back to Matt. He's a talented individual and, like Stephanie and Brandon, is looking for the opportunities where he can. And his current living situation is what is providing him that. He says he hasn't forsaken Northwest Indiana and still does enjoy coming back occasionally to see his parents, to help coach football at Andrain High School in Merrillville, and, of course, do his freelance work in the area, too.
In moving to Chicago, you're going, you know that you're getting access to a lot of people doing cool things that you haven't seen before or that you've seen on TV or just better quality of things, like things that are achievable for Northwest Indiana that are in Chicago that draw people right now are the food, the world-class food, cocktails, restaurants, art, and museums, things that, and also just the communities that exist. It's really, at the end of the day, all about the people. You have to eat and you have to drink and that's fun, but that all is just things that facilitate social activities. If you get, basically it starts with the job. If you get the kids there, then they're going to be like, what are we going to eat tonight? Okay, then there's going to be a need for a restaurant there. Then there's going to be a need for some bar for them to hang out in. So,
but that doesn't stop my curiosity on whether or not he would consider returning permanently. He disclosed to me he has a future goal of one day living out in California, but if he wanted to stay in this metro area for the time being, what would it take to do it?
It seems like the trend among young people is that they all want to go and move to a city, right? So, you know, in your view, what do you think that it takes to convince somebody to go ahead and move to Northwest Indiana, where it's like, it's urban in a sense, but it's still like the suburbs as well. You're still in like the metro area, you're just not in the main like neighborhoods or downtown area of the city like you are here. You know, from your perspective, you know, what does that take to do that?
At the end of the day, I just want things to go well for Northwest Indiana and for people that are young to see it as a place that they can still hang out in. But for right now, it's falling short for me in terms of the restaurants and in terms of things to do, music. Everybody goes to Chicago for, even if you live in there, you want to go to Chicago and play. That's the big ticket.
And we'll bring you part two of this Northwest Indiana Times byline report very soon. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, it's Thursday, it's our Reporters Roundtable discussion of the big stories of the week in Northwest Indiana. We hope that you'll join us for that tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking.